From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake's new book, where he excoriates the president and his own Republican Party, is causing quite a stir. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Flake should focus on passing legislation rather than attacking the president. And yet Flake has voted mostly in favor of Trump's policies. We talk with the junior senator from Arizona about why he thinks the Republican Party has lost its way and what he plans to do about it. That's next on Forum. Join us after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Arizona Senator Jeff Flake gained notoriety last summer when he challenged then-nominee Donald Trump during a tense meeting with other Republican senators. Now he has emerged as one of President Trump's most vocal Republican critics, with his new book out this week. It's titled Conscience of a Conservative, A Rejection of Destructive Politics and a Return to Principle. And in it, Flake writes about his own party. We pretended that the emperor wasn't naked. Even worse, we checked our critical faculties at the door and pretended that the emperor was making sense. Senator Flake joins us to talk about what he sees as the greatest threats to conservative principles and democratic institutions. Good morning, Senator Jeff Flake.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. Welcome to Forum. I know you started writing this book in secret last summer. Was there a particular moment or event that caused you to say, I have to write this?
Well, you know, we had the, after the 2012 election for Republicans, when we lost, when our candidate was Mitt Romney, we famously sat down as a party and wrote an autopsy and decided that we Republicans needed to play to a broader audience, in particular that we couldn't afford to alienate minority groups anymore. George W. Bush won his election with 56% of the white vote. Mitt Romney got 59% of the white vote and lost. Every 4 years, the electorate becomes 2% less white. And unless we can appeal to a broader audience, then we're going to write ourselves off as a party. And I saw last summer this autopsy kind of being thrown aside, and candidates kind of trying to play to the base and trying to rile up the base to make up for maybe the broader outreach. And I thought that you can win an election here or there doing that, but it's not a governing philosophy of populism. And I'm afraid that we've got to change if we want to be a governing majority.
On the day that President Trump endorsed the Muslim ban, you tweeted, just when you think @real Donald Trump can stoop no lower, he does. Is that in part what you're talking about?
Yes. I thought December of 15, when he announced the Muslim ban, I felt so strongly about it that I attended afternoon prayers at a mosque with my family, just to show that not all Republicans felt that way. And I think that we have a very real war against terrorism that involves certainly radical Islamic views. But the last thing we need to do is ascribe radical Islamic views to all Muslims. And I thought that that was just unfair and not in keeping with our national security needs either.
Well, you certainly mince no words with President Trump. You describe him as being erratic, unmoored from principle, willing to heap praise on dictators, to speak fondly of countries that crush dissent and murder political opponents. You also write, we degrade our politics enough as it is without turning our democracy over to carnival barkers and reality television. Those are tough words for any sitting president, but one from your own party, Senator Flake.
Well, that's not just directed at Donald Trump. I think people around him as well. And let me just say, this book is not just about the Trump presidency. This is much of the book is talking about how we got here.
Yes,
I got to Congress in 2001. In fact, I was elected along with Mike Pence. We both ran conservative think tanks in the 90s and knew each other then. We're elected together and
into the House. Yes.
Yes, in the House, and we were both disappointed that some of the great debates that Republicans had been having on real issues, on tax policy, on welfare reform, seemed to be shelved. And we, the first thing we considered was President Bush's No Child Left Behind. As a kind of a think tank conservative, I thought that that's not conservative policy. And Mike and I both opposed that. Then the prescription drug benefit came along. We added $7 trillion in unfunded liabilities for the future. And I thought, that's not conservative policy. And then we engaged as Republicans in just the most horrid type of spending, the earmarking that was corrupting. A couple of our colleagues ended up in jail. And ultimately, we lost the majority in the House and the Senate, and then the White House in 2008. And I have to say, we deserved it, given the behavior of the party. And what we really did at that time is, because conservatives could no longer hold on to the mantle of limited government and lower spending, then we kind of cast that aside and then started debates on flag burning and other wedge issues. And we haven't fully come back from that, I'm afraid. And then this campaign, presidential campaign, it wasn't just obviously the policy, the kind of a populist, protectionist, isolationist policy, I thought, that was anonymical to Republicans or conservative thought. It was the behavior as well. And I just I don't think that there's a future for that.
Yes. Your chapter six, the title is How Did This Happen? Our Faustian Bargain, which is a very telling way to title that chapter. You write in that chapter, who could blame the people who felt abandoned and ignored by the major parties for reaching in despair for a candidate who offered oversimplified answers to infinitely complex questions and managed to entertain them in the process? So what, in your view, is the story of the 2016 election?
Well, it's easy for a politician to point to a shuttered factory and say, that's because the Chinese took your job, or the Mexicans took your job. If we would just get rid of those trade deals, then and put America first, then you'd have your job back. And that, obviously, if you're in that position, that sounds good. You want to believe it. But the problem is, the problem is much more complex than that. And I know politics. I'm a politician. I know how you have to appeal to the audience you're in front of. But I think first and foremost, we owe the voters, as conservatives, some form of honesty. And the truth is, some of those factories are shuttered simply because of automation, mechanization. We are manufacturing twice the amount of good services than we did in the 1980s with fewer than one-third the workers we had then because of productivity gains. And that is going to continue. Globalization has occurred. We either harness it or we're going to be left behind by it. But I think it's we have to be honest and say the economy is changing. We'll have to change with it.
Yes, you're certainly, libertarian-minded, free market, limited government conservative, and I know that's what you'd like to see your party get back to in terms of principles. But you also wrote something very interesting here, where you talk about the conservative bargain, essentially, that was made by your party to support President Trump. Essentially, you say, if by 2017 the conservative bargain was to go along for the very bumpy ride because with congressional hegemony in the White House we had the numbers to achieve some long-held policy goals, even as we put at risk our institutions and our values, then it was a very real question whether any such policy victories wouldn't be Pyrrhic ones. If this was our Faustian bargain, then it was not worth it. And I guess I'm wondering then, are you saying that the policy gains that you'd hoped to make, right, were not worth supporting this president?
Well, I think that you found surprise among 90% of Republicans at the election results on November 1st. So I think that most thought that we wouldn't get there, that we wouldn't have, as Republicans, control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. But obviously, when you're in that position, there are policy gains that can be made. The president appoints judges, appoints cabinet members, and members of the administration. I frankly think that President Trump made a stellar choice on the Supreme Court with Judge Gorsuch, who was approved by Democrats and Republicans unanimously just a few years before as a district or a circuit court judge. I think that he's done some good things on regulatory policy. But for the long term, I'm very concerned about the direction that we're headed. With regard to immigration, the immigration reforms outlined yesterday by the president and a few members of Congress, where we moved to a point system for legal immigration. A point system is fine. We even did that in the bipartisan so-called Gang of Eight bill.
Yes, you were part of that.
Mm-hmm. But we didn't cut the number of legal immigrants in half. And I think that would be tremendously damaging to the country economically. So I think on immigration and then on trade, I have obviously a whole chapter on trade. Turning down the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I think will haunt us for years, both economically because we're failing to open up new markets for our goods, but geopolitically as well. These countries, particularly in Southeast Asia, we need to have them in our trade orbit, not just China's trade orbit. And this will have ramifications on several fronts for a long time. And NAFTA, coming from Arizona, let me tell you, NAFTA has been a huge benefit. Prior to NAFTA, we traded about $50 billion total annually with Mexico. Now that's closer to $550 billion. And that benefits Arizona, certainly. It benefits the United States, and it benefits Mexico and Canada. But Mexico, we have net migration south of Mexican migrants across the border because their economy has done better. And a lot of that is owing to NAFTA. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing for us. It's a good thing for them.
We're talking with Arizona Senator Jeff Flake about his new book out this week, Conscience of a Conservative, A Rejection of Destructive Politics and a Return to Principle. So, Senator Flake, how do you square, your a rejection of destructive politics and returning to principle with your willingness to vote for policies such as, the skinny repeal of the Affordable Care Act? You specifically in your book cautioned Republicans against a sloppy repeal using an opaque process, which is exactly what they did, yet you voted for it.
Right. Legislating is never easy. I would have hoped to have kept this reform alive. My concern, first and foremost, Arizona has been kind of ground zero for the failure of the exchange under Obamacare. About 200,000 Arizonans this morning woke up without any health care. They paid the fine, 183,000 of them, but they couldn't afford the insurance. Many of these individuals and families had insurance prior to Obamacare, but they lost it because their insurer pulled out or the premiums just became too unaffordable. So they're paying a fine, and they still don't have insurance. About an equal number or greater have insurance, but in reality they don't because they're paying some $1,500 in premium, like my friend Brent, with a family of four, but he has to pay out of pockets between premiums and deductibles about $30,000 a year before the first insurance dollar kicks in.
Yes, but you also have, I don't even know what the proportion is, but a very large proportion of people in Arizona who get health coverage from Medicaid. I believe it's a quarter
right.
of the population, and these bills were threatening Medicaid significantly.
The bill that we voted on in the end did not touch
yes.
Medicaid at all.
It
only dealt with the exchange and would have given relief to people on the exchange.
We'll
have to deal with both on the Medicaid side and the exchange side, but what was voted on in the end was just with regard to the exchange.
But I guess, Senator Flake, just as a conservative, do you believe that the government should be in the business of regulating health care at all? And if not, why not just be upfront about that?
I do. And I believe that we have accepted as a society that nobody with a pre-existing condition should be left aside and simply can't afford health coverage or care. We can do that in a different way than the way that Obamacare did. Obamacare basically said, we're going to cover people with pre-existing conditions, and we're going to fund that by forcing individuals and businesses to buy an insurance product that they don't want or can't afford. That's why, like I said, about 200,000 people in Arizona are paying the fine, and they still don't have insurance. And so it really damaged badly the insurance market in Arizona for families that just can't afford coverage. There are other ways to cover those with pre-existing condition by funding that directly. I would prefer a direct subsidy rather than simply forcing individuals and families into a situation where they can't afford the coverage or they're buying coverage that they can't afford to use.
If the president, his threat to stop payments to the Affordable Care Act, the federal government's obligations under the Affordable Care Act, would you support appropriating that money?
We'll have to see what he is really going to do. I don't believe that he will stop payment on it. We desperately have to reform these markets. It has to change. They are in Arizona. We only have one insurer in 14 out of 15 counties.
Right.
Just one.
But premiums would go
and
up.
So
we have to
change that, and we can't just continue to just subsidize more fully those who are on the exchange. We can't afford that. We have to use the market to discipline costs or something else. But we cannot afford to continue down this road. What we need to do is find a fiscally sustainable path forward, both on the Medicaid side and the exchange side. And I think what's being lost in the discussion of late is that this a lot of people right now are hurting in Arizona, and to wait and say we'll get to it. And I do support going back to the committee process now. There's only so much that can be done under rules of reconciliation. Most of this is going to have to be fixed sitting across the aisle, and that goes not just for health care, but for the big items on debt and deficit. We'll have to do a grand bargain at some point. And my concern is that if we continue, this kind of ascribing the worst motives to your opponents and saying that they're trying to kill people, and that what they're doing is killing people. I mean, that's some of the worst language I've heard from the left. And then on the right uses the same kind of polemics. And we'll never be able to sit down together and solve these problems with this kind of language on
yes.
both sides.
And you've talked about the polemics, and also, as you've said, it isn't necessarily Donald Trump, in your view, that has brought, you see more as the culmination of a coarseness that was growing in the language of politics,
you
and
bet.
You talk about Newt Gingrich and others.
Yeah, I mean, in the, 2005, I believe it, or no, I'm sorry, it was later 2009 or 10. We had a Republican stand up in the State of the Union address and yell, you lie.
At President Obama, yes.
Yes, you had some people push forward the most ugly conspiracy theories about the president not being born in this country, falsifying his birth certificate. And, I mean, things are just awful. And,
yes.
And it continues, and we can't do that.
You know, you wrote something quite poignant where you said you were at a Tea Party rally and people asked you whether or not you believe that the president was a citizen. And you said you did, and you were booed. And you said that if conspiracy theories are the litmus test for being a conservative, then we have a big problem. You also write that someone needs to do something about it, and that someone is us. And you talk about the threat to democracy that this president is right now as the culmination of what you see as a misinformed electorate in many ways, and one that's whose essentially gullibility is being exploited by your party. So I guess the question I have for you is, what would it take for you to act to check the president of the United States? Would it be if he attempted to fire Mueller, for example, which he has, there has been some reports that he's talked about that?
Yes, there are already bipartisan bills that are being put forward that would preempt or prevent the president from firing special counsel without cause.
And what if he tried to fire Jeff Sessions to get at Mueller? Would that be a red line?
You'd have to see if that is seen as a precursor for getting rid of Mueller. And what I have been very heartened by is the number of senators, of my colleagues, who have come out in defense of Jeff Sessions. I haven't even seen that on the left. People who haven't necessarily agreed with Jeff Sessions. I mean, I've had my own issues with Jeff Sessions. I was in a different place on immigration reform during the bipartisan bill that we did, civil asset forfeiture, things with sentencing reform. I've been on the other side of Jeff, but let me tell you, he has integrity, and I think he showed that when he recused himself, and he was right to do so.
Senator,
so I think that if he were removed and people saw that as a precursor, then you'd see the Senate step up. But it's not just that. It's just on the language, too. I mentioned on the Bertha thing that our party, more elected officials should have stood up earlier on that and condemned it.
Why has the GOP been so hesitant to do that, even though it sounds like the views you have are shared among your colleagues?
You know, it's this us versus them kind of thing that is prevails on both sides, I have to say. It really is. And I mean, it's when you have news outlets that simply take sides. And Charlie Sykes, the former talk show host, wrote about the best piece on it. And talking on the right about this being kind of the anti-Trump, where if somebody is anti-Trump, then you have to be anti-them. And it doesn't revolve anymore about principle or policy. It's just protecting your guy or protecting your party. And I just, you know, those are destructive politics, and both on the right and the left. You just want to say to people, change the channel, whatever you're watching. If it's MSNBC all day or Fox all day or CNN all day, change the channel once in a while. Or if you're younger, change your news feed. Get outside of your news feed because this is very destructive. Because in the end, the biggest deal, in my view, that we have to deal with is our looming debt and deficit, $20 trillion. We're going to be adding $1 trillion a year in a couple of years to that $20 trillion.
We're talking with Arizona Senator Jeff Flake about his new book out this week, Conscience of a Conservative, A Rejection of Destructive Politics and a Return to Principle. You, our listeners, can join our conversation. What are your questions for Senator Flake? Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on our website, on Facebook, or on Twitter. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, whose new book, Conscience of a Conservative, A Rejection of Destructive Politics and a Return to Principle, calls out the president and his own party, which he says has put party over country. It's drawn strong criticism from many on the right, as well as praise. Michael Gerson wrote that Flake's new book is a white-hot indictment of Republican cowardice in the face of a hostile ideological takeover and the single largest act of political bravery of the Trump era. We'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. The number again, 866-733-6786. Our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. You can also find us on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, and email us at forum@kqed.org. Senator Flake, this listener tweets, is he ready to lose his seat next election? You have been described as the most endangered Republican running for re-election. And you have, I believe, an 18% approval rating in Arizona. There was a poll just out that said you'd lose to a generic Democrat at, 47 to 31%.
Well, keep in mind, any off-year poll like that. In fact, at this point, with John McCain 2 years ago, I think his approval rating was 30% approve, 60% disapprove, or something like that. And he went on to win double digits in both the primary and the general. So off-year polls by partisans don't mean as much. Having said that, this is not a good time, political consultants would tell you. to write a book. You never want to introduce any variables or any uncertainty into an election period. And that's why I wrote this book without telling anybody outside of my family until it was almost finished. I recognize that that carries political risk, but I think that this was important enough to say. And the consequences will be what they are, but there are more things, things more important than winning re-election, in my view. I hope that that people see this for what it is. This is an affirmation of conservative principle. It's consistent with what I've been saying during my time in politics. But I thought that it was important enough to do it now, regardless of the election season.
Well, there have been, of course, as I said, the Democrats are targeting your seat more conservative or more, I guess you don't like even using the term more conservative, but more Trumpian candidates, I suppose, are targeting your seat. But you're also raising your name recognition with this book. And some are wondering if you're actually contemplating a run for president or challenging a sitting president.
No, how far can you get with a name like Flake?
Named the region where you are from, right? It was in Arizona, Snowflake, Arizona, which, of course, ironically, is a term of derision for the left. But
I grew up not knowing that flake was a pejorative term at all. I mean, nobody made fun of us there. So it was quite a shock to learn that people thought flake was a funny word when I left town.
Yes, you grew up on a cattle ranch, and that shaped your views on migrant labor. Is that right? Is that what's behind some of your views on immigration?
Very much so. I grew up next to migrant labor. We employed many on our farm, and the hardest working people I ever knew. And try as I might, I could never look at them and see a criminal class that came to support their families. And I've tried since I've been in office to find humane immigration reform that recognizes the complexity of the issue and recognize the value of immigration and what they've contributed to our society.
Well, I want to ask you if you could respond to these two comments. Aaron writes, ask him what specific actions he's taken to date to live that conscience, not just write about it. Pamela writes, the senator shows up to work every day and could make the difference he seeks in how he votes, how he speaks, and who he supports. It is the worst kind of hypocrisy and opportunism to make his observations, which I believe to be true, and then show up to work every day and do nothing about them. Actions, not words, Senator.
Well, let's go back to immigration. I came to the Senate in 2013 and immediately joined a gang. I thought I'd left gang life behind after the mean streets of Snowflake, but I joined the Gang of Eight, four Republicans, four Democrats, and we hammered out an immigration bill that was, a tough sell to some in Arizona. But I felt that it was important. Support the DREAM Act, just co-sponsored it once again, and it's been included in every comprehensive piece of immigration reform that I've either put forward or supported. With regard to the president's Muslim ban, I spoke out against that, and again, the travel ban. And there's a chapter in the book on why I don't support the travel ban, as the president has put it forward.
Yes.
Spoken out of it. In terms of votes, I just voted with the majority in the House and the Senate over opposition from the president to provide additional sanctions on Russia. Some will point to and say, well, 95% of the time you voted with the president this year.
Yes,
almost every vote in the Senate so far this year has been on personnel. It's the president's cabinet picks or a Supreme Court justice or filling out the administration. There are some 1,500 positions that are subject to Senate confirmation.
Yes, but I guess the question is, Senator, sorry for interrupting you, but I just want to, I think what they're sort of getting at was Neil Gorsuch and some deregulation worth what you see as destructive politics? Do you know what I mean?
Not at all. Neil Gorsuch was confirmed unanimously, Democrats and Republicans, when he was a circuit court judge. to try to paint him outside of the mainstream is just wrong.
Yes,
and
but
with
how
regulatory
do you
reform, I think we all recognize businesses, small and large, the overregulation that has occurred. I'm a conservative. I make no apologies for that. I favor conservative policies.
Yes.
I know on some things I differ on what is conservative. I've supported and worked with President Obama on Cuba policy because I felt if you really want to get at the Castros, make them deal with spring break once or twice. You know, just let Americans travel to Cuba. That's a freedom issue for me. So I part ways sometimes with my conservative Republican colleagues on what is conservatism, how it impacts on freedom. But I'm a conservative, and I think some, expect that if you're opposed to the president on one thing, you ought to be opposed on everything. That's just not the case.
But you're not opposed to the president on one thing. You're opposed largely, right, to the system that's getting us here, I guess. And so what is the relationship, in your view, between conservative principles and standing up for conservative principles and conservative policies, right, to support?
Right.
Yes.
One thing in terms of process, and I think this may help with the listener. One thing that's coming to the fore right now is the president is pushing the Senate to try to get rid of the Senate filibuster because that would make it easier to enact some policies.
Mm-hmm.
I've come out four square against that. We should not get rid of the filibuster. That forces the parties to work together, and that's a good thing. When you have one party pushing forward without aid of the other party, then we get something like Obamacare that was flawed. It would have been far better had both parties sat down together. And I recognize Republicans didn't make that easy at that time. But we are at our best in the Senate when we sit across the aisle and craft legislation together.
Well, let's hear from our listeners. Michael in Oakland. Hi, Michael.
Hi. So one of the first things to which Senator Flake alluded was the autopsy that was done after the 2012 election and how with the shifting demographics in the country that the Republican Party really can't win and govern if they're just fighting for a shrinking share of older white voters. I guess the problem that is embedded in the system with that reasoning is that although that's true at a national level, at the level of each individual, certainly member of the House and to a lesser extent senator, you know, their first fight and their most important fight is still a primary vote
mm-hmm.
with Republican primary voters who are, of course, exactly extremely conservative, white, Republican Party loyalists, you know, mostly older, yada, yada, yada.
So, yeah. Michael, thanks. Good point. And Senator Flake, yes, with gerrymandered districts, I mean, what do you do here?
Well, I do address that in the book, and I point to that as one of the reasons that we have such polemics now. I couldn't agree more. It's been so easy now with sophisticated software, mapping software, for politicians to choose their voters rather than voters to choose their politicians. And that is a big problem. Some states, like Arizona, have moved to a redistricting commission that tries to take it out of the hands of partisan legislators. That's worked to some extent. It's bounced back and forth. But that is a big problem. We don't have that with the Senate, obviously, because we're elected statewide. But it is a big problem, and it has driven politics to the extremes.
Do you support citizens' commissions, then, independent citizens' commissions?
It depends on how they're structured. I do support ways to try to take it out of the hands of those who benefit from it and to prevent it from seesawing back and forth, depending on who's in charge.
Well, I want to thank Michael for the question. Go to Elizabeth in Oakland. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I want to thank you for your measured and thoughtful approach that will hopefully increase critical thinking and extend the collective attention span of our nation. So I want to address health care. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm a Medicare provider. Right now I'm doing what they call Medi-Medi, which is Medicare and Medicaid. We call it Medi-Cal in California. I've provided Medicaid services over the course of 20 years. Right now, when I do Medi-Medi work, I know I'm not going to get a penny from Medi-Cal or Medicaid. I'm not going to get a penny. Medicare is working well enough that I get reimbursed sufficiently, and I'm helping people who need help, and so that works for me. So I want to address separating the provision of health care from what they call the health insurance marketplace. And you need to take the profit motive undoubtedly out of both, but I'm more concerned about the profit motive of the health insurance component. And why should we? I'm also a mother, so we're consumers of health care, and I'm a clinical psychologist, so I'm a doctor who sincerely wants to help people in my professional life.
Well, Elizabeth, I think we get your point. Senator Flake, do you have a response?
Well, I think take the profit motive out of the insurance industry. I think you may be pointing toward what they're calling single payer, where if you don't have insurance at all, then you are just providing care, not coverage, insurance coverage, and that would be single payer. I'm not in favor of single payer. I think that we, at our best, if we can structure a system and have had and still have a system better than those countries with single payer. And so I'm not going there.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you. Brian writes, tell Senator Flake that there's a big difference from civil court and the Supreme Court, especially when his party stole that Supreme Court seat. Peter also tweets, Merrick Garland, don't let him off the hook. Senator Flake, was it fair not to give Merrick Garland a hearing?
You know, the Republicans decided to do was not without precedent. You'd have to go back to 1888. To find a time when the party that was out or was going out named somebody who made it through the process in a similar situation to what we had. So this was not without precedent. I do mention in the book.
But isn't that in some ways the Faustian bargain you talk about?
I do fear that it will just be back and forth. And the Democrats will do the same thing coming up. So one thing, the broader point on the filibuster as it relates to the president's executive calendar, and this goes to the polemics we're talking about, after George W. Bush won the contested election with the hanging chads and everything else in 2000, there were so many Democrats who felt he just isn't the legitimate president and couldn't accept him as a legitimate president. They decided in the Senate for the first time ever to start routinely filibustering the president's executive calendar, Supreme Court nominees, other court nominees, and cabinet picks. That had never been done before. And then when Barack Obama was elected, she was on the other foot, and the Republicans decided to do the same. And it's escalated. I'm concerned that that we're going to, that's going to lead to other issues as well.
So you consider that destructive politics?
I think it is, but it didn't start there last year.
Well,
the continuation of it.
Does that justify it? I guess
a time where we can move these through more quickly.
Well,
I can tell you the people who are saying that this is unprecedented, it's not happened. It was more following precedent than not. Like I said, you'd have to go back to 1888 to find a similar scenario where the party would have pushed through such a nominee.
Well, let me get a couple of other listener comments on the record. Skip writes, Jeff Flake was one of the Gang of Eight who tried to push through a miserable comprehensive immigration reform bill in about 2013. How does he regard that experience? Robert writes, in California, the Affordable Care Act has worked imperfectly but has largely succeeded. If Arizona has had trouble implementing the ACA, it's because Arizona's State House has behaved foolishly. Let's hear from Ed in Palo Alto. Hi, Ed.
Hi, thank you for having me. As usual, and unsurprisingly, a fantastic program. I have a question for Senator Flake. He stood in a room where McConnell, his leader, said that their number one agenda was stopping Obama's policies. For 8 years, he supported McConnell. Okay, for 8 years, he was part of the group that obstructed probably one of the, maybe not none of one of the strongest presidents in the United States, but one of the better presidents in the United States. Now, all these Republicans whose seats are in danger have a come to Jesus moment. How does that
yes,
work?
Yes, Ed, thank you.
Why is it that now we have to trust them? Thank you.
Ed, thank you. Actually, Senator, you write about this in your book, actually, your concerns about McConnell's statements about making that the focus would be making President Obama a one-term president.
No, I was in the House during that time, so I wasn't in any room where that was set. And that was not just Senator McConnell. That's kind of been the mantra of a lot of Republicans. And frankly, it's been similar, on the other side now. I can tell you, with President Obama, for all the talk and criticism of Mitch McConnell in that statement, if you look at the number of nominees that the president put forward, that the Republicans, through unanimous consent, allowed the president to staff his cabinet and his administration, and compare that to today, it's the Democrats have taken it to a new level in terms of obstruction. That's awful. We just this week were able to move a number of nominees that have been waiting for so long. So this is not a problem just on one side of the aisle. Myself, with regard to President Obama, I mentioned I worked with him on a number of things, on Cuba policy, on Africa policy, sentencing reform. I enjoyed working with him on those things. The day before President Obama left office, I got a call from him, and we'd become friends working on some of those issues together. I can tell you, I think that we ought to oppose presidents when we believe they're wrong and support them when I think they're right. Let me just go back a little. When I got to the House, I mentioned I opposed President Bush's signature, No Child Left Behind.
His and education
then his prescription
initiative.
Drug benefits, yes. And then I opposed his Cuba policy for 8 years. But then President Bush just came and did a fundraiser for me a couple of months ago because I was with him on other things. And he overlooked that we disagreed on some issues and understood that not every Republican senator is a rubber stamp for any president. And I think today it's much more statement you ought to be a litmus test kind of Republican or Democrat and agree on everything with the president. And that's just not the case. That's not what I think my constituents here in Arizona expect of me. They expect of me to be independent enough to say, hey, when the president picks somebody for the Supreme Court or does some regulatory reform we agree with, I ought to be with him. But if he tries to nullify NAFTA, for example, or rip it up, as he said during the campaign, I will oppose him, and I should.
Well, Andres Wright, speaking of your constituents, I feel unwelcome as a person of color in Arizona and could never find good-paying work in my hometown of Nogales. What will you do to help Arizona turn its course?
Well, I think Arizona is we're recovering well from the recession that we had. But Arizona, like I said, we benefit greatly from cross-border trade and NAFTA. And Arizona understands perhaps better than some other states that aren't border states the value.
Yes, but Andres also says he feels unwelcome as a person of color.
I don't know how to answer that other than I think the policies that we've pushed are universal. Limited government, economic freedom, I think, benefit everyone. But we shouldn't, and part of the problem I had with the president's statements during the campaign, when he referred to migrants from Mexico as rapists, or, referred to the judge born in Indiana as a Mexican in a pejorative way. That's when I spoke out against that kind of rhetoric, and that's not appropriate for any public official, in my view.
Well, Senator Flake, you've said that your party has tremendous powers of denial, and you've talked about being sympathetic to that impulse to denial. You also talked about, I know you've defended yourself in terms of trying to stand up to the president, but you also talked about how you, you know, basically tried to evade questions related to the president's tweets, and that you think that is very problematic in the Republican Party.
It's tough. I mean, just yesterday, I was walking to a vote, and a bunch of reporters were saying, what do you think of the president? I think the state was blaming Congress for our poor relations with Russia.
Yes.
And I can tell you the temptation is always to just, you know, I don't respond to tweets, and I don't think we should be expected to respond to every tweet that comes out. You know, we, as I make the point in the book, we have to stand up at some points. We have to stand up and say this just isn't right. Let me just give you an example. I saw a poll. And I have a whole chapter on kind of fake news and how we respond to it and what we should do. And the damage that, you know, we have in a society where we don't have truths that are self-evident, that we don't have shared truths that we can start from. I saw a poll that said 49% of Republicans believe that Donald Trump won the popular vote.
Yes.
And Donald Trump won the Electoral College. He is our president. That's how we do it here. But he didn't win the popular vote. That should be a truth that is self-evident.
And you call those statements, like the president calling things that are unfavorable to him fake news, saying that that he would have won the popular vote had it not been for millions of people voting illegally. You call those a threat to democracy. Do you consider the president a threat to democracy?
No, well, I say when you make statements like that, you erode the public trust, and you erode the system that we have, where we do accept some things as fact, and we accept the election results. Now, the election results, and that's why this is so puzzling that the president keeps talking about this. But the president won the election. He won the Electoral College. That's how we do it. But where it does make a difference is there's an effort going on right now to look at electoral practices, you know, around the states. And the president and the administration has asked for certain information from each of the states. Some states are complying and some aren't. And I think that so this is very much an issue that we ought to and should weigh in on. I think that the states do a great job. Particularly at the local level with all the volunteers and others. We have a good system. I don't want to change it and federalize it, if you will, or have the federal government more involved in that way. So I think that we have an obligation to stand up on some of these issues. We can't respond to every tweet, obviously, but we've got to understand that it's our place to stand up.
Well, let me try to get another call in here. Chris in San Jose. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My question is, how do you justify saying that people can't use their health insurance and have to pay $30,000 before they get any benefit from it, when the ACA provides for an incredible amount of preventive care with almost no payments at all, other than paying your premiums?
We just have a minute left, and another listener writes, the senator agrees that pre-existing conditions should be covered. He says there are other ways to pay for it. How has he done the analysis on what this would cost the government? So can you address Chris and this listener's questions about health care, Senator
Flake?
Yeah,
so there was, I mean, some states had pretty effective risk pools prior to Obamacare, and some still run some kind of risk pools. Maine is a good example of the one that worked. And there was a question of what would it take to expand that nationwide. And I believe that those figures are within the realm that we could do a direct subsidy
and not force everybody to buy the coverage that either doesn't fit their needs or they simply can't afford. I can tell you, I know so many families that simply can't afford it, that are paying the fine and are choosing to do other things. They have to make choices that I think families shouldn't have to make.
Well, Senator Flake, with the seconds we have left, are you trying to start a movement? Have you seen your colleagues follow you in your critique of the president and the party?
I know that a lot of my colleagues have told me that they've enjoyed the book. I hope everybody will read the book and we'll go from there.
Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, the new book is Conscience of a Conservative, a Rejection of Destructive Politics and a Return to Principle. Thanks for joining us this morning, Senator.
Thank you.
I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Up next, we'll have an hour on California groundwater and a new podcast called Ear Hustle. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.